sold concessions to those who desired to do so. Beyond the colony complex rose the first of the atmosphere processors. Fusion-powered, it belched a steady storm of cleansed air back into the gaseous envelope that surrounded the planet. Particulate matter and dangerous gases were removed either by burning or by chemical breakdown. Oxygen and nitrogen were thrown back into the dim sky. In with the bad air, out with the good. It was not a complicated process, but it was time-consuming and very expensive. But how much is a world worth? And Acheron was not as bad as some that the company had invested in. At least it possessed an existing atmosphere capable of modification. Much easier to fine-tune the composition of a world's air than provide it from scratch. Acheron had weather and near-normal gravity, a veritable paradise. The fiery glow that emanated from the crown of the volcano-like atmosphere processor suggested another realm entirely. None of the symbolism was lost on the colonists. It inspired only additional humor. They hadn't agreed to come to Acheron because of the weather. There were no soft bodies or pallid, weak faces visible within the colony corridors. Even the children looked tough. Not tough as in mean or bullying, but strong within as well as without. There was no room here for bullies. Cooperation was a lesson learned early. Children grew up faster than their earthbound counterparts and those who lived on fattier, gentler worlds. They and their parents were a breed unto themselves, self-reliant yet interdependent. They were not unique. Their predecessors had ridden in wagons instead of starships. It helped to think of oneself as a pioneer. It sounded much better than a numerical job description. At the center of this ganglion of men and machines was the tall building known as the control block. It towered above every other artificial structure on Acheron, with the exception of the atmosphere processing stations themselves. From the outside, it looked spacious. Within, there wasn't a spare square meter to be found. Instrumentation was crowded into corners and sequestered in the crawl spaces beneath the floors and the service ways above the suspended ceilings. And still there was never enough room. People squeezed a little closer to one another so that the computers and their attendant machines could have more room. Paper piled up in corners despite unceasing efforts to reduce every scrap of necessary information to electronic bytes. Equipment shipped out new from the factory quickly acquired a plethora of homey scratches, dents, and coffee cup rings. Two men ran the control block and therefore the colony. One was the operations manager, the other his assistant. They called one another by their first names. Formality was not in vogue on frontier worlds. Insistence on titles and last names and too much supercilious pulling of rank could find a man lost outside without a survival suit or communicator. Their names were Simpson and Lidecker, and it was a toss-up as to which looked more harried than the other. Both wore the expression of men for whom sleep is a teasing mistress rarely visited. Lidecker looked like an accountant haunted by a major tax deduction misplaced 10 years earlier. Simpson was a big, burly type who would have been more comfortable running a truck than a colony. Unfortunately, he'd been stuck with brains as well as brawn and hadn't managed to hide it from his employers. The front of his shirt was perpetually sweat-stained. Lidecker confronted him before he could retreat. "See the weather report for next week?" Simpson was chewing on something fragrant which stained the inside of his mouth. Probably illegal, Lidecker knew. He said nothing about it. It was Simpson's business, and Simpson was his boss. Besides, he'd been considering borrowing a chew. Small vices were not encouraged on Acheron, but as long as they didn't interfere with a person's work, neither were they held up to ridicule. It was tough enough to keep one's sanity, hard enough to get by.
"What about it?"
the operations manager said. "We're going to have a real Indian summer. Winds should be all the way down to 40 knots."
"Oh, good. I'll break out the inner tubes and the suntan lotion. Heck, I'd settle for just one honest glimpse of the local sun.
Lydecker shook his head, affecting an air of mock disapproval.
Never satisfied, are you? Isn't it enough to know it's still up there?
I can't help it. I'm greedy. I should shut up and count my blessings, right? You got something else in your mind, Lydecker? Or are you just on one of your hour-long coffee breaks?
It's me. Goof off every chance I get. I figure my next chance will be in about 2 years.
He checked a printed readout.
You remember you sent some wildcatters out to that high plateau out past the Ilium Range a couple of days ago?
Yeah. Some of our dreamers back home thought there might be some radioactives out that way. So I asked for volunteers, and some guy named Jordan stuck up his mitt. I told him to go look if they wanted to. Some others might have taken off in that direction also. What about it?
There's a guy in the horn right now. Mom and Pop survey team. Says he's homing something and wants to know if his claim will be honored.
Everybody's a lawyer these days. Sometimes I think I should have gone in for it myself.
What, and ruin your sophisticated image? Besides, there's not much call for lawyers out here. And you make better money.
Keep telling me that. It helps.
Simpson shook his head and turned to gaze at a green screen.
Some hunch in a cushy office on Earth says go look at a grid reference in the middle of nowhere. We look. They don't say why, and I don't ask. I don't ask because it takes 2 weeks to get an answer from back there, and the answer's always don't ask. Sometimes I wonder why we bother.
I just told you why, for the money.
The assistant operations officer leaned back against a console.
So, what do I tell this guy?
Simpson turned to stare at a video screen that covered most of one wall. It displayed a computer-generated topographical map of the explored portion of Acheron. The map was not very extensive, and the features it illustrated made the worst section of the Kalahari Desert look like Polynesia. Simpson rarely got to see any of Acheron's surface in person. His duties required him to remain close to operations at all times, and he liked that just fine.
Tell him, he informed Lydecker, that as far as I'm concerned, if he finds something, it's his. Anybody with the guts to go crawling around out there deserves to keep what he finds.
The tractor had 6 wheels, armored sides, oversized tires, and a corrosion-proof underbody. It was not completely Acheron-proof, but then very little of the colony's equipment was. Repeated patching and welding had transformed the once sleek exterior of the tractor into a collage composed of off-color metal blotches held together with solder and epoxy sealant. But it kept the wind and sand at bay and climbed steadily forward. That was enough for the people it sheltered. At the moment, it was chugging its way up a gentle slope, the fat tires kicking up sprays of volcanic dust that the wind was quick to carry away. Eroded sandstone and shale crumbled beneath its weight. A steady westerly gale howled outside its armored flanks, blasting the pitted windows and light ports in its emotionless, unceasing attempt to blind the vehicle and those within. The determination of those who drove combined with the reliable engine to keep it moving uphill. The engine hummed reassuringly, while the air filters cycled ceaselessly as they fought to keep dust and grit out of the sacrosanct interior. The machine needed clean air to breathe just as much as did its occupants. He was not quite as weather-beaten as his vehicle, but Russ Jordan still wore the unmistakable look of someone who'd spent more than his share of time on Acheron. Weathered and wind-blasted. To a lesser degree, the same description applied to his wife, Anne, though not to the 2 children who bounced about in the rear of the big central cabin. Somehow they managed to dart in and around portable sampling equipment and packing cases without getting themselves smashed against the walls. Their ancestors had learned at an early age how to ride something called a horse. The action of the tractor was not very different from the motion one has to cope with atop the spine of that empathetic quadruped. and the children had mastered it almost as soon as they learned how to walk. Their clothing and faces were smeared with dust, despite the nominally inviolable interior of the vehicle. That was a fact of life on Acheron. No matter how tight you tried to seal yourself in, the dust always managed to penetrate vehicles, offices, homes. One of the first colonists had coined a name for this phenomenon that was more descriptive than scientific. Particulate osmosis, he'd called it. Acheronian science. The more imaginative colonists insisted that the dust was sentient, that it hid and waited for doors and windows to open a crack before deliberately rushing inside. Homemakers argued facetiously whether it was faster to wash clothes or scrape them clean. Russ Jordan wrestled the massive tractor around boulders too big to climb and negotiated a path through narrow crevices in the plateau they were ascending. He was sustained in his efforts by the music of the locator's steady pinging. It grew louder the nearer they came to the source of the electromagnetic disturbance, but he refused to turn down the volume. Each ping was a melody unto itself, like the chatter of old-time cash registers. His wife monitored the tractor's condition and the life support systems while her husband drove.
"Look at this fat, juicy magnetic profile," Jordan tapped the small readout on his right. "And it's mine, mine, mine. Lydecker says that Simpson said so, and we've got it recorded. They can't take that away from us now. Not even the company can take it away from us. Mine, all mine."
"Half mine, dear." His wife glanced over at him and smiled.
"And half mine."
This cheerful desecration of basic mathematics came from Newt, the Jordan's daughter. She was 6 years old, going on 10, and she had more energy than both her parents and the tractor combined. Her father grinned affectionately without taking his eyes from the driver's console.
"I got too many partners."
The girl had been playing with her older brother until she'd finally worn him out.
"Tim's bored, Daddy, and so am I. When are we going back to town?"
"When we get rich, Newt."
"You always say that."
She scrambled onto her feet as agile as an otter.
"I want to go back. I want to play Monster Maze."
Her brother stuck his face into hers.
"You can play by yourself this time. You cheat too much."
"Do not."
She put small fists on unformed hips.
"I'm just the best, and you're jealous."
"I'm not. You go in places we can't fit."
"So? That's why I'm the best."
Their mother spared a moment to glance over from her bank of monitors and readouts.
"Knock it off. I catch either of you two playing in the air ducts again, I'll tan your hides. Not only is it against colony regulations, it's dangerous. What if one of you missed a step and fell down a vertical shaft?"
"Oh, Mom, nobody's dumb enough to do that. Besides, all the kids played, and nobody's been hurt yet. We're careful."
Her smile returned.
"And I'm the best, because I can fit places nobody else can."
"Like a little worm."
Her brother stuck his tongue out at her. She duplicated the gesture.
"Yeah, yeah, jealous, jealous."
He made a grab for her protruding tongue. She let out a childish shriek and ducked behind a mobile ore analyzer.
"Look, you two,"
there was more affection than anger in Ann Jordan's tone, "let's try to calm down for 2 minutes, okay?
We're almost finished up here. We'll head back towards town soon, and..."
Russ Jordan had half risen from his seat to stare through the windshield. Childish confrontations temporarily put aside, his wife joined him.
"What is it, Russ?"
She put a hand on his shoulder to steady herself as the tractor lurched leftward.
"There's something out there. Clouds parted for just a second and I saw it. I don't know what it is, but it's big. And it's ours, yours and mine, and the kids."
The alien spacecraft dwarfed the tractor as the big six-wheeler trundled to a halt nearby. twin arches of metallic glass swept skyward in graceful but somehow disturbing curves from the stern of the derelict. From a distance, they resembled the reaching arms of a prone dead man locked in advanced rigor mortis. One was shorter than the other, and yet this failed to ruin the symmetry of the ship. The design was as alien as the composition. It might have been grown instead of built. The slick bulge of the hull still exhibited a peculiar vitreous luster that the wind-borne grit of Acheron had not completely obliterated. Jordan locked the tractor's brakes.
"Folks, we have scored big this time. And break out the suits. I wonder if the Hadley Cafe can synthesize champagne."
His wife stood where she was, staring out through the tough glass.
"Let's check it out and get back safely before we start celebrating, Russ. Maybe we're not the first to find it."
"Are you kidding? There's no beacon on this whole plateau. There's no marker outside. Nobody's been here before us. Nobody. She's all ours."
He was heading towards the rear of the cabin as he talked, and still sounded doubtful.
"Hard to believe that anything that big, putting out that kind of resonance, could have sat here for this long without being noticed."
"Bull."
Jordan was already climbing into his environment suit, flipping catches without hunting for them, closing seal tights with the ease of long practice.
"You worry too much. I can think of plenty of reasons why it's escaped notice until now."
"For instance?"
Reluctantly, she turned from the window and moved to join him in donning her own suit.
"For instance, it's blocked off from the colony's detectors by these mountains. And you know that surveillance satellites are useless in this kind of atmosphere."
"What about infrared?"
She zipped up the front of her suit.
"What infrared? Look at it. Dead as a doornail. Probably been sitting here just like that for thousands of years. Even if it got here yesterday, you couldn't pick up any infrared on this part of the planet. New air coming out of the atmosphere processor is too hot."
"So then how did operations hit on it?"
She was slipping on her equipment, filling up the instrument belt. He shrugged.
"How the heck should I know? If it's bugging you, you can winkle it out of Lydecker when we get back. The important thing is that we're the ones they picked to check it out. We lucked out."
He turned towards the airlock door.
"Come on, babe. Let's crack the treasure chest. I'll bet that baby's insides are just crammed with valuable stuff."
Equally enthusiastic, but considerably more self-possessed, Ann Jordan tightened the seals on her own suit. Husband and wife checked each other out. Oxygen, tools, lights, energy cells, all in place. When they were ready to leave the tractor, she popped her wind visor and favored her offspring with a stern gaze.
"You kids stay inside. I mean it."
"Oh, Mom!"
Tim's expression was full of childish disappointment.
"Can't I come too?"
"No, you cannot come too. We'll tell you all about it when we get back."
She closed the airlock door behind her. Tim immediately ran to the nearest port and pressed his nose against the glass. Outside the tractor, the twilight landscape was illuminated by the helmet beams of his parents.
"Well, I don't know why I can't go too."
"Because Mommy said so."
Newt was considering what to play next as she pressed her own face against another window. The lights from her parents' helmets grew dim as they advanced towards the strange ship. Something grabbed her from behind. She squealed and turned to confront her brother.
"Cheater!"
he jeered. Then he turned and ran for a place to hide. She followed, yelling back at him. The bulk of the alien vessel loomed over the two bipeds as they climbed the broken rubble that surrounded it. Wind howled around them. Dust obscured the sun.
"Shouldn't we call in?"
Anne stared at the smooth-sided mass.
"Let's wait till we know what to call it in as."
Her husband kicked a chunk of volcanic rock out of his path.
"How about big weird thing.
Russ Jordan turned to face her, surprise showing on his face behind the visor.
Hey, what's the matter, honey? Nervous? We're preparing to enter a derelict alien vessel of unknown type. You bet I'm nervous.
He clapped her on the back.
Just think of all that beautiful money. The ship alone's worth a fortune, even if it's empty. It's a priceless relic. Wonder who built it, where they came from, and why it ended up crashed on this godforsaken lump of gravel.
His voice and expression were full of enthusiasm as he pointed to a dark gash in the ship's side.
There's a place that's been torn open. Let's check her out.
They turned towards the opening. As they drew near, Ann Jordan regarded it uneasily.
I don't think this is the result of damage, Russ. It looks integral with the hull to me. Whoever designed this thing didn't like right angles. I don't care what they liked. We're going in.
A single tear wound its way down Nuke Jordan's cheek. She'd been staring out the fore windshield for a long time now. Finally, she stepped down and moved to the driver's chair to shake her sleeping brother. She sniffed and wiped away the tear, not wanting Tim to see her cry.
Timmy, wake up, Timmy. They've been gone a long time.
Her brother blinked, removed his feet from the console, and sat up. He glanced unconcernedly at the chronometer set in the control dash, then peered out at the dim, blasted landscape. Despite the tractor's heavy-duty insulation, one could still hear the wind blowing outside when the engine was shut down. Tim sucked on his lower lip.
It'll be okay, Newt. Dad knows what he's doing.
At that instant, the outside door slammed open, admitting wind, dust, and a tall, dark shape. Newt screamed, and Tim scrambled out of the seat as their mother ripped off her visor and threw it aside, heedless of the damage it might do to the delicate instrumentation. Her eyes were wild, and the tendons stood out in her neck as she shoved past her children. She snatched up the dash mic and yelled into the condenser,
"Mayday! Mayday! This is Alpha Kilo 249er calling Hadley Control. Repeat, this is Alpha Kilo..."
Newt barely heard her mother. She had both hands pressed over her mouth as she sucked on stale atmosphere. Behind her, the tractor's filters whined as they fought to strain the particulate-laden air. She was staring out the open door at the ground. Her father lay there, sprawled on his back on the rocks. Somehow her mother had dragged him all the way back from the alien ship. There was something on his face. It was flat, heavily ribbed, and had lots of spider-like chitinous legs. The long, muscular tail was tightly wrapped around the neck of her father's environment suit. More than anything else, the creature resembled a mutated horseshoe crab with a soft exterior. It was pulsing in and out like a pump, like a machine. Except that it was not a machine. It was clearly, obviously, obscenely alive. Newt began screaming again, and this time she didn't stop. Chapter 3. It was quiet in the apartment except for the blare of the wall screen. Ripley ignored the simp calm and concentrated instead on the smoke rising from her D-nicotine cigarette. It formed lazy, hazy patterns in the stagnant air. Even though it was late in the day, she'd managed to avoid confronting a mirror. Just as well, since her haggard, unkempt appearance could only depress her further. The apartment was in better shape than she was. There were just enough decorative touches to keep it from appearing Spartan. None of the touches were what another might call personal. That was understandable. She'd outlived everything that once might have been considered personal. The sink was full of dirty dishes, even though the dishwasher sat empty beneath it. She wore a bathrobe that was aging as rapidly as its owner. In the adjoining bedroom, sheets and blankets lay in a heap at the base of the mattress. Jones prowled the kitchen, hunting overlooked morsels. He would find none. The kitchen kept itself reasonably antiseptic despite a deliberate lack of cooperation from its owner.
"Hey, Bob," the wall screen bleated vapidly. "I heard that you and the family are heading off for the colonies."
"Best decision I ever made, Phil,"
replied a fatuously grinning non-entity from the opposite side of the wall.
"We'll be starting a new life from scratch in a clean world. No crime, no unemployment."
And the two chiseled performers who were acting out this administration-approved spiel probably lived in an expensive green ring on the East Coast, Ripley thought sardonically as she listened to it with half an ear. In Cape Cod, condos overlooking Martha's Vineyard or Hilton Head or some other unpolluted, high-priced snob refuge for the fortunate few who knew how to bill and coo and dance, yassa, dance when imperious corporate chieftains snapped their fingers. None of that for her. No smell of salt, no cool mountain breezes. Inner city company dole. And lucky she was to have that much. She'd find something soon. They just wanted to keep her quiet for a while until she calmed down. They'd be glad to help her relocate and retrain, after which they'd conveniently forget about her, which was just dandy Kino fine as far as she was concerned. She wanted no more to do with the company than the company wanted to do with her. If only they hadn't suspended her license, she'd long since have been out of here and away. The door buzzed sharply for attention, and she jumped. Jones merely glanced up and meowed before trundling off towards the bathroom. He didn't like strangers. Always had been a smart cat. She put the cigarette aside, guaranteed to contain no carcinogens, no nicotine, and no tobacco, harmless to your health, or so the warning label on the side of the packet insisted, and moved to open the door. She didn't bother to check through the peephole. Hers was a full security building. Not that after her recent experiences there was anything in an Earthside city that could frighten her. Carter Burke stood there, wearing his usual apologetic smile. Standing next to him and looking formal was a younger man clad in the severe dressed black uniform of an officer in the Colonial Marines. "Hi, Ripley," Burke indicated his companion. "This is Lieutenant Gorman of the..." The closing door cut his sentence in half. Ripley turned her back on it, but she'd neglected to cut power to the hall speaker. Burke's voice reached her via the concealed membrane. "Ripley, we have to talk."
"No, we don't. Get lost, Carter, and take your friend with you." "No can do. This is important." "Not to me, it isn't. Nothing's important to me."
Burke went silent, but she sensed he hadn't left. She knew him well enough to know that he wouldn't give up easily. The company rep wasn't demanding, but he was an accomplished wheedler. As it developed, he didn't have to argue with her. All he had to do was say one sentence.
"We've lost contact with the colony of Acheron."
A sinking feeling inside as she mulled over the ramifications of that unexpected statement. Well, perhaps not entirely unexpected. She hesitated a moment longer before opening the door. It wasn't a ploy. That much was evident in Burke's expression. Gorman's gaze shifted from one to the other. He was clearly uncomfortable at being ignored, even as he tried not to show it. She stepped aside.
"Come in."
Burke surveyed the apartment and gratefully said nothing, shying away from inanities like, "Nice place you have here," when it obviously wasn't. He also forbore from saying, "You're looking well," since that also would have constituted an obvious untruth. She could respect him for his restraint. She gestured towards the table.
Want something? Coffee? Tea? Spritz?
Coffee would be fine, he replied.
Gorman added a nod. She went into the compact kitchen and dialed up a few cups. Bubbling sounds began to emanate from the processor as she turned back to the den.
You didn't need to bring the Marines.
She smiled thinly at him.
I'm past the violent stage. The psych tech said so, and it's right here on my chart.
She waved towards a desk piled high with disks and papers.
So what's with the escort?
I'm here as an official representative of the Corps.
Gorman was clearly uneasy and more than willing to let Burke handle the bulk of the conversation.
How much did he know, and what had they told him about her, she wondered.
Was he disappointed in not encountering some stoned harridan? Not that his opinion of her mattered.
So, you've lost contact, she feigned indifference. So?
Burke looked down at his slimline, secured briefcase.
It has to be checked out. Fast. All communications are down. They've been down too long for the interruption to be due to equipment failure. Acheron's been in business for years. They're experienced people, and they have appropriate backup systems. Maybe they're working on fixing the problem right now, but it's been no-go, dead silence for too long. People are getting nervous. Somebody has to go and check it out in person. It's the only way to quiet the nervous Nellies.
Probably they'll correct the trouble while the ship's on its way out, and the whole trip will be a waste of time and money, but it's time to set out.
He didn't have to elaborate. Ripley had already gotten where he was going and returned.
She went into the kitchen and brought out the coffees. While Gorman sipped his cup of brew, she began pacing. The den was too small for proper pacing, but she tried anyway. Burke just waited.
No, she said finally. There's no way.
Hear me out. It's not what you think.
She stopped in the middle of the floor and stared at him in disbelief.
Not what I think? Not what I think? I don't have to think, Burke. I was reamed, steamed, and dry-cleaned by you guys, and now you want me to go back out there? Forget it!
She was trembling as she spoke. Gorman misinterpreted the reaction as anger, but it was pure fear. She was scared. Gut scared and trying to mask it with indignation. Burke knew what she was feeling, but pressed on anyway. He had no choice.
Look, he began in what he hoped was his best conciliatory manner, we don't know what's going on out there. If their relay satellite's gone out instead of the ground transmitter, the only way to fix it is with a relief team. There are no spacecraft in the colony. If that's the case, then they're all sitting around out there cursing the company for not getting off its collective butt and sending out a repair crew pronto. If it is the satellite relay, then the relief team won't even have to set foot on the planet itself. But we don't know what the trouble is, and if it's not the orbital relay, then I'd like to have you there, as an advisor. That's all.
Gorman lowered his coffee.
You wouldn't be going in with the troops. Assuming we even have to go in, I can guarantee your safety.
She rolled her eyes and glanced at the ceiling.
These aren't your average city cops or army accompanying us, Ripley, Burke said forcefully. These colonial marines are some tough hombres, and they'll be packing state-of-the-art firepower. Man plus machine. There's nothing they can't handle, right, Lieutenant?
Gorman allowed himself a slight smile.
We're trained to deal with the unexpected. We've handled problems on worse worlds than Acheron. Our casualty rate for this kind of operation hovers right around zero. I expect the percentage to improve a little more after this visit.
If this declaration was intended to impress Ripley, it failed miserably. She looked back to Burke.
What about you? What's your interest in this?
Well, the company co-financed the colony in tandem with the colonial administration.
Sort of an advance against mineral rights and a portion of the long-term developmental profits. We're diversifying, getting into a lot of terraforming. Real estate on a galactic scale, building better worlds and all that.
Yeah, yeah, she muttered. I've seen the commercials.
The corporation won't see any substantial profits out of Acheron until terraforming's complete. But a big outfit like that has to consider the long term.
Seeing that this was having no effect on his host, Burke switched to another tack.
I hear you're working in the cargo docks over portside.
Her reply was defensive, as was to be expected.
That's right. What about it?
He ignored the challenge.
Running loaders, forklifts, suspension grates, that sort of thing?
It's all I could get. I'm crazy if I'm going to live on charity all my life. Anyway, it keeps my mind off everything. Days off or worse. Too much time to think. I'd rather keep busy.
You like that kind of work?
Are you trying to be funny?
He fiddled with the catch on his case.
Maybe it's not all you can get. What if I said I could get you reinstated as a flight officer, get you your license back, and that the company has agreed to pick up your contract? No more hassles with a commission, no more arguments. The official reprimand comes out of your record, without a trace. As far as anyone will be concerned, you've been on a leave of absence. Perfectly normal following a long tour of duty. It'll be like nothing happened. Won't even affect your pension rating.
What about the ECA and the insurance people?
Insurance is settled, over, done with. They're out of it. Since nothing will appear on your records, you won't be considered any more of a risk than you were before your last trip. As far as the ECA is concerned, they'd like to see you go out with a relief team, too. It's all taken care of.
If I go.
If you go.
He nodded, leaning slightly towards her. He wasn't exactly pleading. It was more like a practiced sales pitch.
It's a second chance, kiddo. Most people who get taken down by a board of inquiry never have the opportunity to come back. If the problem's nothing more than a busted relay satellite, all you have to do is sit in your cubbyhole and read while the techs take care of it. That, and collect your trip pay while you're in hypersleep. By going, you can wipe out all the unpleasantness and put yourself right back up there where you used to be. Full rating, full pension accumulation, the works.
I've seen your record. One more long out trip, and you qualify for a captain's certificate.
And it'll be the best thing in the world for you to face this fear and beat it. You gotta get back on the horse.
Spare me, Burke, she said frostily. I've had my psych evaluation for the month.
His smile slipped a little, but his tone grew more determined.
Fine. Let's cut the crap, then. I've read your evaluations. You wake up every night, sheets soaking, the same nightmare over and over. No!
The answer is no.
She retrieved both coffee cups, even though neither was empty. It was another form of dismissal.
Now please go. I'm sorry. Just go, would you?
The two men exchanged a look. Gorman's expression was unreadable, but she had the feeling that his attitude had shifted from curious to contemptuous. The heck with him. What did he know? Burke mined a pocket, removed a translucent card, and placed it on the table before heading for the door. He paused in the portal to smile back at her.
Think about it.
Then they were gone, leaving her alone with her thoughts. Unpleasant company. Wind. Wind and sand and a moaning sky. The pale disk of an alien sun fluttering like a paper cutout beyond the riven atmosphere. A howling rising in pitch and intensity, coming closer until it was right on top of you, smothering you, cutting off your breath. With a guttural moan, Ripley sat straight up in her bed, clutching her chest. She was breathing hard, painfully, sucking in a particularly deep breath. She glanced around the tiny bedroom. The dim light set in the nightstand illuminated bare walls, a dresser, and a highboy, sheets kicked to the foot of the bed. Jones lay sprawled atop the highboy, the highest point in the room, staring impassively back at her. It was a habit the cat had acquired soon after their return. When they went to bed, he would curl up next to her, only to abandon her soon after she fell asleep, in favor of the safety and security of the highboy. He knew the nightmare was on its way, and gave it plenty of space. She used a corner of the sheet to mop the sweat from her forehead and cheeks. Fingers fumbled in the nightstand drawer until they found a cigarette. She flicked the tip and waited for the cylinder to ignite. Something. Her head snapped around. Nothing there. Only the soft hum of the clock. There was nothing else in the room. Just Jones and her. Certainly no wind. Leaning to her left, she pawed through the other nightstand drawer until she'd located the card Burke had left behind. She turned it over in her fingers, then inserted it into a slot in the bedside console. The video screen that dominated the far wall immediately flashed the words, "Stand by," at her. She waited impatiently until Burke's face appeared. He was bleary-eyed and unshaven, having been roused from a sound sleep, but he managed a grin when he saw who was calling.
"Hello. Ah, Ripley. Hi.
Burke, just tell me one thing."
She hoped there was enough light in the room for the monitor to pick up her expression as well as her voice.
"That you're going out there to kill them. Not to study. Not to bring back. Just burn them out clean. Forever."
He woke up rapidly, she noted.
"That's the plan. If there's anything dangerous walking around out there, we get rid of it. Got a colony to protect. No monkeying around with potentially dangerous organisms. That's company policy. We find anything lethal, anything at all, we fry it. A scientist can go suck eggs, my word on it."
A long pause, and he leaned towards his own pickup, his face looming large on the screen.
"Ripley? Ripley? You still there?"
No more time to think. Maybe it was time to stop thinking and to do.
"All right, I'm in."
There, she'd gone and said it. Somehow, she'd said it. He looked like he wanted to reply, to congratulate or thank her. Something. She broke the connection before he could say a word. A thump sounded on the sheets next to her, and she turned to gaze fondly down at Jones. She trailed short nails down his spine, and he primped delightedly, rubbing against her hip and purring.
"And you, my dear, are staying right here."
The cat blinked up at her as he continued to caress her fingers with his back. It was doubtful that he understood either her words or the gist of the previous phone call, but he did not volunteer to accompany her.
"At least one of us still has some sense left," she thought, as she slid back beneath the covers.
Chapter 4. It was an ugly ship. Battered, overused, parts repaired that should have been replaced. Too tough and valuable to scrap. Easier for its masters to upgrade it and modify it than build a new one. Its lines were awkward and its engines oversized. A mountain of metal and composites and ceramic, a floating scrap heap. Weightless monument to war. It shouldered its way brutally through the mysterious region called hyperspace. Like its human cargo, it was purely functional. Its name was Sulaco. 14 dreamers this trip, 11 engaged in related Morphean fantasies, simple and straightforward as the vessel that carried them through the void. 2 others, more individualistic. A last sleeping under sedation necessary to mute the effects of recurring nightmares. 14 dreamers, and one for whom sleep was a superfluous abstraction. Executive Officer Bishop checked readouts and adjusted controls. The long wait was ended. An alarm sounded throughout the length of the massive military transport. Long dormant machinery, powered down to conserve energy, came back to life. So did long dormant humans as their hypersleep capsules were charged and popped open. Satisfied that his charges had survived their long hibernation, Bishop set about the business of placing Sulaco in a low geostationary orbit around the colony world of Acheron. Ripley was the first of the sleepers to awake. Not because she was any more adaptive than her fellow travelers, or more used to the effects of hypersleep, but simply because her capsule was first in line for recharge. Sitting up in the enclosed bed, she rubbed briskly at her arms, then started to work on her legs. Burke sat up in the capsule across from her, and the lieutenant, what was his name? Oh, yeah, Gorman, beyond him. The other capsules contained the Sulaco's military complement, 8 men and 3 women. They were a select group in that they chose to put their lives at risk for the majority of the time they were awake. Individuals used to long periods of hypersleep followed by brief but intense periods of wakefulness. The kind of people others made room for on a sidewalk or in a bar. PFC Spunkmeyer was the dropship crew chief, the man responsible, along with Pilot Corporal Farrow, for safely conveying his colleagues to the surface of whichever world they happened to be visiting, and then taking them off again in one piece. In a hurry, if necessary. He rubbed at his eyes and groaned as he blinked at the hypersleep chamber. I'm getting too old for this. No one paid any attention to this comment, since it was well known, or at least widely rumored, that Spunkmeyer had enlisted when underage. However, nobody joked about his maturity, or lack of it, when they were plummeting towards the surface of a new world in the PFC-directed dropship. Private Drake was rolling out of the capsule next to Spunkmeyer's. He was a little older than Spunkmeyer, and a lot uglier. In addition to sharing similarities in appearance with the Sulaco, likewise he was built a lot like the old transport. Drake was heavy-duty bad company, with arms like a legendary one-eyed sailor, a nose busted beyond repair by the cosmetic surgeons, and a nasty scar that curled one side of his mouth into a permanent sneer. The scar surgery could have fixed it, but Drake hung on to it. It was one medal he was allowed to wear all the time. He wore a tight-fitting floppy cap, which no living soul dared to refer to as cute. Drake was a smart gun operator. He was also skilled in the use of rifles, handguns, grenades, assorted blades, and his teeth.
"They ain't paying us enough for this," he mumbled.
"Not enough to have to wake up to your face, Drake."
This from Corporal Dietrich, who was arguably the prettiest of the group, except when she opened her mouth.
"Suck vacuum," Drake told her.
He eyed the occupant of another recently opened capsule.
"Hey, Hicks, you look like I feel."
Hicks was the squad's senior corporal and second-in-command among the troops after Master Sergeant Apone. He didn't talk much and always seemed to be in the right place at the potentially lethal time, a fact much appreciated by his fellow Marines. He kept his counsel to himself while the others spouted off. When he did speak, what he had to say was usually worth hearing. Ripley was back on her feet, rubbing the circulation back into her legs and doing standing knee bends to loosen up stiffened joints. She examined the troopers as they shuffled past her on their way to a bank of lockers. There were no supermen among them, no overly muscled archetypes, but every one of them was lean and hardened. She suspected that the least among them could run all day over the surface of a 2G world carrying a full equipment pack, fighting a running battle while doing so, and then spend the night breaking down and repairing complex computer instrumentation. Brawn and brains aplenty, even if they preferred to talk like common street toughs. The best the contemporary military had to offer. She felt a little safer, but only a little. Master Sergeant Apon was making his way up the center aisle, chatting briefly with each of his newly revived soldiers in turn. The sergeant looked as though he could take apart a medium-sized truck with his bare hands. As he passed ComTech Corporal Hudson's pallet, the latter voiced a complaint. "This floor is freezing."
"So were you 10 minutes ago. I never saw such a bunch of old women. Want me to fetch your slippers, Hudson?"
The corporal batted his eyelashes at the sergeant.
"Would you, sir? I'd be ever so grateful."
A few rough chuckles acknowledged Hudson's riposte. Apone smiled to himself as he resumed his walk, chiding his people and urging them to speed it up. Ripley stayed out of their way as they trudged past. They were a tightly knit bunch, a single fighting organism with 11 heads, and she wasn't a part of their group. She stood outside, isolated. A couple of them nodded to her as they strode past, and there were one or two cursory hellos. That was all she had any right to expect, but it didn't make her feel any more relaxed in their company. PFC Vasquez just stared as she walked past. Ripley had received warmer inspections from robots. The other smart gun operator didn't blink, didn't smile. Black hair, blacker eyes, thin lips. Attractive, if she'd make half an effort. It required a special talent, a unique combination of strength, mental ability, and reflexes to operate a smart gun. Ripley waited for the woman to say something. She didn't open her mouth as she passed by. Every one of the troopers looked tough. Drake and Vasquez looked tough and mean. Her counterpart called out to her as she came abreast of his locker.
"Hey, Vasquez, you ever been mistaken for a man?"
"No. Have you?"
Drake proffered an open palm. She slapped it, and his fingers immediately clenched right around her smaller fingers. The pressure increased on both sides, the silent, painful greeting. Both were glad to be out from under hypersleep and alive again. Finally, she whacked him across the face, and their hands parted. They laughed, young Dobermans at play. Drake was the stronger, but Vasquez was faster, Ripley decided as she watched them. If they had to go down, she resolved to try to keep them on either side of her. It would be the safest place. Bishop was moving quietly among the group, helping with massages and a bottle of special post-sleep fluid, acting more like a valet than a ship's officer. He appeared older than any of the troopers, including Lieutenant Gorman. As he passed close to Ripley, she noticed the alphanumeric code tattooed across the back of his left hand. She stiffened in recognition, but said nothing.
"Hey," Private Frost said to someone out of Ripley's view, "you take my towel?"
Frost was as young as Hudson, but better looking, or so he would insist to anyone who would waste time listening. When it came time for bragging, the two younger troopers usually came out about even. Hudson tended to rely on volume while Frost hunted for the right words. Spunkmeyer was up near the head of the line and still complaining.
"I need some slack, man. How come they send us straight back out like this? It ain't fair. We got some slack coming, man."
Hicks murmured softly.
"You just got 3 weeks. You want to spend your whole life on slack time?"
"I mean breathing, not this frozen stuff,"
3 weeks in a freezer ain't real off time.
Yeah, Top, what about it?
Dietrich wanted to know.
You know it ain't up to me.
Rapone raised his voice above the griping.
All right, let's knock off the jawing. First assembly's in 15. I want everybody looking like human beings by then. Most of you will have to fake it. Let's shag it.
Hypersleep wear was stripped off and tossed into the disposal unit. Easier to cremate the remains and provide fresh new attire for the return journey than to try to recycle shorts and tops that had clung to a body for several weeks. The line of lean, naked bodies moved into the shower. High-pressure water jets blasted away accumulated sweat and grime, set nerve endings tingling beneath scoured skin. Through the swirling steam, Hudson, Vasquez, and Farrow watched Ripley dry off.
Who's the fresh meat again?
Vasquez asked the question as she washed cleanser out of her hair.
She's supposed to be some kind of consultant. Don't know much about her.
The diminutive Farrow wiped at her belly, which was as flat and muscular as a steel plate, and exaggerated her expression and tone.
She saw an alien once. And so the skip chat says.
Whoa! Hudson made a face. I'm impressed.
Apone yelled back at them. He was already out in the drying room, toweling off his shoulders. They were as devoid of fat as those of troopers 20 years younger.
Let's go! Let's go! Bunch of lazy butts'll run the recyclers dry. Come on, cycle through. You gotta get dirty before you can get clean.
Informal segregation was the order of the day in the mess room. It was automatic. There was no need for whispered words or little nameplates next to the glasses. Apone and his troopers requisitioned the large table, while Ripley, Gorman, Burke, and Bishop sat at the other. Everyone nursed coffee, tea, spritz, or water while they waited for the ship's auto chef to deal out eggs and ersatz bacon, toast and hash, condiments, and vitamin supplements. You could identify each trooper by his or her uniform. No two were exactly alike. This was the result not of specialized identification insignia, but of individual taste. The Sulaco was no barracks, and Acheron no parade ground. Occasionally, Apone would have to chew someone out for a particularly egregious addition, like the time Crow had showed up with a portrait of his latest girlfriend computer stenciled across the back of his armor. But for the most part, he let the troopers decorate their outfits as they liked.
Hey, Top, Hudson chivied. What's the op?
Yeah.
Frost blew bubbles in his tea.
All I know is I get shipping orders and not time to say hello goodbye to Myrna.
Myrna?
Private Wierzbowski raised a bushy eyebrow.
I thought it was Lena.
Frost looked momentarily uncertain.
I think Lena was 3 months ago. Or six.
It's a rescue mission.
Apone sipped his coffee.
There's some juicy colonist daughters we gotta rescue.
Pharaoh made a show of looking disappointed.
Hell, that lets me out.
Says who?
Hudson leered at her. She threw sugar at him. Apone just listened and watched. No reason for him to intervene. He could have quieted them down, could have played it by the book. Instead, he left it loose and fair, but only because he knew that his people were the best. He'd walk into a fight with any one of them watching his back and not worry about what he couldn't see, knowing that anything trying to sneak up on him would be taken care of as efficiently as if he had eyes in the back of his head. Let him play, let him curse ECA and the Corps and the company, and him too. When the time came, the playing would stop, and every one of them would be all business.
Dumb colonists!
Spunkmeyer looked to his plate as food began to put in an appearance. After 3 weeks of sleep, he was starving, but not so starving that he couldn't offer the obligatory soldier's culinary comment.
What's this stuff supposed to be?
Eggs, dimwit, said Pharaoh.
I know what an egg is, bubble brain. I mean this soggy, flat, yellow stuff on the side.
Cornbread, I think.
Wierzbowski fingered his portion and added absently,
Hey, I wouldn't mind getting me some more of that Arcturan poontang. Remember that time?
Hicks was sitting on his right side. The corporal glanced up briefly, then looked back to his plate.
Looks like that new lieutenant's too good to eat with us lowly grunts. Kissing up to the company rep.
Wierzbowski stared past the corporal, not caring if anyone should happen to notice the direction of his gaze.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if he knows his job, said Crow.
The magic word,
Frost hacked at his eggs.
We'll find out.
Perhaps it was Gorman's youth that bothered them, even though he was older than half the troopers. More likely it was his appearance. Hair neat even after weeks in hypersleep. Slack creases, sharp and straight. Boots gleaming like black metal. He looked too good. As they ate and muttered and stared, Bishop took the empty seat next to Ripley. She rose pointedly and moved to the far side of the table. The XO looked wounded.
I'm sorry you feel that way about synthetics, Ripley.
She ignored him as she glared down at Burke, her tone accusing.
You never said anything about there being an android on board.
Why not?
Don't lie to me either, Carter. I saw his tattoo outside the showers.
Burke appeared nonplussed.
Well, it didn't occur to me.
I don't know why he's so upset. It's been company policy for years to have a synthetic on board every transport. They don't need hypersleep, and it's a lot cheaper than hiring a human pilot to oversee the interstellar jumps. They won't go crazy working a long-haul solo. Nothing special about it.
I prefer the term artificial person myself,
Bishop interjected softly.
Is there a problem? Perhaps it's something I can help with.
I don't think so.
Burke wiped egg from his lips. A synthetic malfunctioned on her last trip out. Some deaths were involved.
I'm shocked. Was it long ago?
Quite a while, in fact.
Burke made the statement without going into specifics, for which Ripley was grateful.
Must have been an older model, then.
Hyperdyne Systems 128-2.
Bending over backwards to be conciliatory, Bishop turned to Ripley.
Well, that explains it. The old A-2s were always a bit twitchy. That could never happen now. Not with the new implanted behavioral inhibitors. Impossible for me to harm or, by omission of action, allow to be harmed a human being. The inhibitors are factory installed, along with the rest of my cerebral functions. No one can tamper with them. So you see, I'm quite harmless.
He offered her a plate piled high with yellow rectangles.
More cornbread?
The plate did not shatter when it struck the far wall as Ripley smacked it out of his hand. Cornbread crumbled as the plate settled to the floor.
Just stay away from me, Bishop. You got that straight? You keep away from me.
Wierzbowski observed this byplay in silence, then shrugged and turned back to his food.
She don't like the cornbread either.
Ripley's outburst sparked no more conversation than that as the troopers finished breakfast and retired to the ready room. Ranks of exotic weaponry lined the walls behind them. Some clustered their chairs and started an improvised game of dice. Tough to pick up a floating crap game after you've been unconscious for 3 weeks, but they tried nonetheless. They straightened lazily as Gorman and Burke entered, but snapped to when Apone barked at them.
Cheers up!
The men and women responded as one, arms vertical at their sides, eyes straight ahead, and focused only on what the sergeant might say to them next. Gorman's eyes flicked over the line. If possible, the troopers were more motionless standing at attention than they had been when frozen in hypersleep. He held them a moment longer before speaking. At ease? The line flexed as muscles were relaxed. I'm sorry we didn't have time to brief you before we left Gateway, but...
Sir,
said Hudson. Annoyed, Gorman glanced towards the speaker. Couldn't let him finish his first sentence before starting with the questions. Not that he'd expected anything else. He'd been warned that this bunch might be like that. Yes, what is it, Hicks? The speaker nodded at the man standing next to him.
Hudson, sir. He's Hicks.
What's the question, soldier?
Is this going to be a